Jeannie in Medford dropped a question off about why people hold grudges. And let me throw on top of that my question about your general thought on free-floating grumpiness, not necessarily attached to any one experience or a series of them.
Right. Well, I think the holding on to grudges is a great example of the negativity bias, because if you think about it, you know, there's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, resentment, grudges, is taking poison and then waiting for others to die. In other words, it harms us usually much more than the other person to hold on to the grudge, and yet we still do it. And I think that's an example of the negativity bias, in that the brain overlearns from those negative experiences and then really protects them, because that's a great way to keep animals alive in the wild. But, you know, as anyone who's held a grudge, me included, knows, it's a lousy way to, you know, experience quality of life and so forth. So for me, what's useful is to find that middle place where you're both recognizing mistreatment. You know, you're not being a doormat, and you're doing whatever is appropriate and you can to assert yourself, and also have compassion for yourself and be on your own side, while at the same time trying to, you know, move on, trying to get your mind out of it. You know, if it's bad enough that they did that thing to you in the first place, even worse if you let them keep doing it to you, banging around inside your own head. And then second, in terms of free-floating grumpiness, there's a term in psychology called defensive pessimism. And there's a place, I think, and some people use it to kind of orient to life in a slightly aversive way, or a, kind of a grumpy or you know, anxious or worried way. I mean, it is a strategy. The problem with that is that while it can accomplish certain purposes, you know, in terms of energizing oneself if you're grumpy, or alerting oneself to threats, you know, or if you're grumpy or if you're anxious, on the other hand, maybe there's a better way to get that same beneficial result. Maybe we can, you know, see the real negative things in the world clearly without starting with a certain free-floating grumpiness. That said, you know, the truth is, Jeff, everybody has got a temperament. We're all messed up. You know what I mean? And, you know, my temperament tends to be a little mildly anxious. I have one of my best friends. His temperament tends to be free-floating grumpiness. You know, I just saw him last night. And, you know, and other people may be kind of mopey in their own temperament. And that's okay. I think sometimes people, you know, they feel bad because they have a temperament. And the truth is, it's just your temperament. The question is, though, is there a freedom in relationship to it? Or is it running the show?
Ah, good point. Let us take a call here from Skeeter and Eugene. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Hansen. His book is Hardwiring Happiness.
Hiya, gents. What a great day, even with the gray.
Mm-hmm.
A while back, I was listening to a program that suggested that about 85% of the stuff that we worry about either never did happen or it's not going to happen, and that there's only about 15% of the stuff that we worry about that we really ought to pay attention to. And then also, a couple of years ago, a really great psychologist counselor suggested to me that when I'm focusing on the really good experiences that I'm having and I'm feeling really good, or I'm feeling real positive about directions that I'm making, to not only dwell on that, as your guest suggests, you know, for 15, 20 seconds, and really integrate it into your system, but to actually do something physical, even subtly physical, such as rubbing your index finger against your thumb very lightly, or letting your hand rest on your chest to feel your heart, to integrate that mind-body connection, to actually get the physicality mixed in with that thinking, so that the next time something stressful happens, you can rub your fingers together lightly, and that can bring you back into the moment and realize, oh, I'm making choices all the time. How do I want to deal with this? I want to move into a positive direction. All that stuff that you had when you initially were doing that, when you were having those positive experiences, I think it really helps. It works for me, and I highly suggest it. Anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for that, Skeeter. Let's take another call from Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Hansen. His book is Hardwiring Happiness.
Yes, hi. Hi, Rick. I greatly appreciate your work. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you.
And I've got some of your CDs and listened to them, and I've actually attended a lot of the webinars you presented at, and I've enjoyed them all. Okay, that said, I think that the kind of strategies that you and other folks propose to take in the good sometimes work a whole lot better when the people trying to apply them have had the great gift of growing up in a state of being securely attached, because that provides a basis of internal safety for coping with life's difficulties. And when you get knocked off, you can find your way back quicker. Because I think such people with insecure attachment are much more readily derailed by any kind of unexpected negative experience, and they have a much harder time making it back. Because they might have a lot of shame triggered by their negative experience and tend to blame themselves for their difficulties. So when I hear statements like, most people are about as happy as they decide to be, I think they often land in such people as yet another failure when they can't just decide to be happy like everybody's telling they should be.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd like to see is strategies specifically designed to support change in people who've grown up with insecure attachment, because it is so much more difficult to get back to a enough of a steady state of relative safety so they can actually use the strategy you propose. I think that might help people who have a really hard time focusing on the good to learn how to do so.
All right. Thanks for that call, Sandy. Thoughts, Rick?
I think that's really a deep point. And by the way, Sandy, thank you for your kindness here to me personally. On the one hand, it's really true that if there are already more senses of more of a sense of resources inside, including secure attachment, you know, let's say rooted in a good childhood, then it's certainly easier to draw upon them for some felt sense of the good, on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, as someone who's been working with people a really long time and had his own rocky childhood, I have really come to appreciate the extraordinary power of the mind and brain system to gradually change itself for the better, you know, the self-directed neuroplasticity idea. And so I think it's especially true that if someone has had an insecurely attached childhood or other experiences of feeling mistreated or just not getting enough of the good stuff, then everyday life is particularly important to draw upon to look for those moments to really have an experience that's your own antidote experience, as I've said earlier, of, let's suppose, in terms of attachment, feeling included or seen or appreciated or liked or loved. Any one of those, you know, any part in a storm can gradually, slowly but surely fill the hole in your heart. And it's only 10 or 20 or 30 seconds at a time. You know, it's one drop at a time. But drop by drop, you know, as the Buddha talked about a long time ago, using a metaphor, drop by drop is the water pot filled. And I have seen so many people, I suspect, you know, the caller's on the path himself, I've just seen so many people who really have gradually done this thing, bit by bit, you know, informally in daily life, and then, you know, in my book I get into the, you know, ways to turbocharge this process. But you can really fill the hole in your heart gradually over time. I certainly have, and I've known many other people who've done that too.
Kit in Arcata writes, it seems to me that religious practice, such as Christian prayer or Buddhist meditation practice, is a time-tested method of rewiring the brain. Could your guest comment on how this might be an important evolved function of religions for human beings, balancing out our natural anxieties, allowing us to focus more on the positive, not only momentarily, but throughout our lives?
That's a very interesting point, and an area of a lot of interest these days, and also controversy, of course. So 2 points about it quickly. First point, the research on the impact on the brain of, you know, meditation or other forms of contemplative practice is really remarkable. Now, most of that research has been done on either TM, which is essentially a Hindu type of practice, or on mindfulness meditation, more of a Buddhist type practice, although people can do either of those practices outside of their original religious context. There have been some studies on Christian practices, but not very many. Nonetheless, those studies show that meditation is actually really good for the brain, including, for example, building up structure in the brain in regions that are involved in both self-awareness and empathy for others, and also regions that do the executive functions I spoke about earlier, just behind the forehead, you know, regulating attention and our feelings and our actions. So that's good. Second, as to whether, you know, religion is an evolutionarily evolved way to support the brain or confer other benefits, that's a really complicated question. People, I think, over the ages have learned to do various things that work, whether it's, you know, going for a walk with a friend or standing out underneath the stars, you know, with a sense of awe, or doing some kind of inner practice that quiets the mind and maybe one that is linked to some felt sense of something transcendental, something divine, something religious in that sense. So I think different things work to draw upon the capacities of the brain to be centered and so forth. I don't think the brain evolved in order to stand under the stars and feel awe, and I just am not sure at all whether the brain evolved in order to apprehend the transcendental, if you're like me and think there is an X factor out there. I think the brain mainly evolved to, if not entirely evolved, to keep animals alive. That said, we still have capacities to compose symphonies or do crossword puzzles, as a caller said. The brain didn't evolve to do crossword puzzles or make symphonies, but it does have the capacities to do those things and then draw upon them, going to the focus of my book, draw upon those useful experiences, not wasting them, to help them have some kind of lasting value that steepens our own learning curve as we go through life.
Rick Hansen, I want to return to the HEAL acronym, Have a Positive Experience, Enrich It, Absorb It, Link Positive and Negative. One of the things you talk about is separating liking from wanting good experiences. What's the difference between liking and wanting in this context?
Very interesting. Okay, two parts. So first, again, quickly, HEAL just, as you say, means it's the how of turning passing mental states into lasting neural traits. In other words, it's a fancy way of describing how can we take good experiences in everyday life into ourselves to build up good stuff inside ourselves in lasting ways. So that's what that acronym is about. And then, I've completely slipped on the second part of your question.
It was the liking and wanting.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, it is said that liking without wanting is heaven, but wanting without liking is hell. In other words, in many ways, the art in life, I think from any kind of framework, and certainly it's true and from a more Eastern perspective, is to be able to find the middle way in which we are enjoying what's pleasant, where we are tolerating what's unpleasant, but we're not tipping into craving, so-called, with reference to either what's pleasant or unpleasant. In other words, we're not shifting out of the experience just in the moment of something being, you know, pleasant or unpleasant, liking or not liking. We're not tipping from that into wanting in the problematic sense of the word wanting. In other words, we're not tipping into a sense of drivenness and addiction, let's say, for what's pleasant, or going to war with what's unpleasant. The art, I think, is to be able to be, you know, passionate and ambitious and strong for what's difficult in life without getting sucked into the underlying sense of deficit or disturbance that drives the red zone of the brain, its reactive mode, which is a way to talk about, you know, in a modern neuropsychological way, as it were, the second noble truth of Buddhism, the truth of what actually is craving. I think the art is to repeatedly take in positive experiences so that we can rest in what's pleasant and let it be a passing experience. We can rest in what's unpleasant and let it be a passing experience while staying in the green zone, as it were, while staying responsive in relationship to what's pleasant or unpleasant without moving into fight or flight or freeze with regard to it.
So finally then, why link positive with negative experiences?
Super great question. As usual, I should listen to you more often. You know, the idea is to have the positive decontaminate the negative. In other words, to do what people do routinely in everyday life, and especially happens routinely in therapy, where we hold both positive and negative material in awareness at the same time. For example, you could have a present moment sense of just being cared about. You know, on the 0 to 10 intensity scale, it's a 1 or a 2, but it's still real. Maybe someone's nice to you at work, or your cat crawls into your lap, as happens for me, or maybe someone compliments you about something or other. Okay, you're now having this experience, and you want to let it be very real. Like the caller said, who talked about rubbing his finger and thumb together. You want to anchor it in your body. You want it to become really strong for you, okay? At the same time, if you want, you could be aware of some current life experience of feeling mistreated or put down or excluded by somebody, hurt, or even bring up childhood material where you felt abandoned, maybe your own experience of insecure attachment, let's say. And then by holding both of those in awareness at the same time, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, only for a little bit of time, you can gradually sense that the positive material is connecting with and easing and even eventually replacing the negative material.
Great. So clearing out the old bad stuff. The process is called Hardwiring Happiness. Rick Hansen is the author of the book by that name. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff. It was a pleasure.
Good to have you.